It's almost as much a part of American culture as baseball, the process of apologizing in public. It happens a lot, especially in politics. And there's such a broad spectrum of apologies, from the ones where the person really appears to be contrite and regretful, to the ones where the apologist blames the media, his upbringing, American culture, and her political opponents for forcing the error that required an apology in the first place. Today's guest has been watching the process, not just recent examples, but through history as well. Edwin Battistella is a linguist at Southern Oregon University. He wrote the book on apologies. It's called Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. Ed, again, teaches at Southern Oregon University. He's the author of several other books, including Bad Language and Do You Make These Mistakes in English? Ed Battistella, thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the Exchange. It's great to be here.
It seems like once you get into this subject, this is a very rich vein. So what was the starting point for you?
Well, I've always been interested in how we do things with words and questions of ambiguity and meaning. But I guess a few years ago, I saw a particularly interesting apology on television where someone apologized sincerely, but then a couple of days later retracted the apology. And I started thinking, well, does that really count as an apology if you take it back a couple of days later? Or if you apologize sincerely one day and then start to weasel out of it a little bit later? So I started to look into some of the sociological literature and linguistic literature and philosophical literature on apologies, and then at a lot of historical examples, and came up with the idea for a book about it, public apologies.
You probably could have filled several volumes, but it is not just a collection. What's the basic goal of the book?
Yeah, the basic goal is to really explore what an apology is. What sort of moral and social work does it do? And how does the language need to coincide with the kind of social and moral work? So I try to go back and forth between some of the theoretical points and then some interesting historic examples so that I'm not kind of boring people with a lot of theory or just giving a lot of cute examples.
All right. So one of the first examples is a good jog for our memories. James Fry is one of the first people mentioned. Remind us what it was that he did.
Well, he wrote this book, I think it was called A Million Little Pieces, in which he basically exaggerated and lied about a lot of the events in the book, having a root canal without anesthesia, a former girlfriend's apparent suicide, and so on. And he was caught in it and basically tried to weasel out of it. Oprah Winfrey at first defended him, and then she apologized to her viewers for defending him when it was clear that he was just lying.
That's the part where the chuckles really begin, because there really was kind of an Oprah Winfrey, James Fry feedback loop going on.
Oh,
for
yeah.
A while.
And then she scolded him on television. And he later apologized for anyone who is offended by errors in his book, I think is how he put it. And then a couple of years later, Oprah started to feel bad about scolding him. And she apologized to him on television, and there were hugs all around. So it was a kind of three-apology circus.
But that kind of apology that you just mentioned, that he said he apologized if people were, I forget how you worded it, but there's a lot of the, I apologize if somebody blank, blank, blank.
Yeah, and that's a kind of verbal judo that people use, where they put the onus of the apology on the person who is offended. So they're really saying, you know, I apologize if you were offended, but if you weren't offended, I don't apologize. So it's really not sincere at all, and you find this in lots of political apologies and lots of celebrity apologies.
I wonder about the speed of political apologies these days, and I'm working a little off the book here at this point, but it seems like that there's a lot of a call instantly from somebody's political opponents, like, you better apologize for that. More so perhaps than it used to be, and maybe that's just because there's just an age of the flavored news, the Fox Newses of the world, where there's a bit of a bent toward the way things are delivered in the first place. But it seems like there are always people ready to pounce instantly and suggest somebody else should apologize for what they just said.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. There's a lot more sort of instant feedback on the news, and the news cycle is much quicker. There have always been these situations where public figures were called on to apologize, Harry Truman, Abe Lincoln, and others. But things proceeded a lot more slowly and a lot more behind the scenes. One of my favorites is Harry Truman, when he insulted the Marine Corps League early on in 1951.
Made my jaw drop. I mean, Harry Truman insulted the Marine Corps? How?
The Marine Corps League, which is a sort of the civilian league of civilian group charged with supporting the Marines, was among several groups lobbying for representation on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Marines weren't on there yet in the 50s. And Harry Truman wrote an intemperate letter to a Republican congressman from California. Gordon McDonough was his name, I think, in which he said, "You know, the Marine Corps has a propaganda machine equal to Stalin's, and as long as I'm the president, they'll remain the Navy's police force."
Really? Okay, so you said that the Navy's police force is going to make the Marine Corps feel just a little slighted, I'm sure.
And the comment about a propaganda machine equal to Stalin's didn't do him any favors either.
There's the big heavy shoe. Okay, we'll come back to that one. A propaganda machine equal to Stalin's from the Marine Corps. Ed Battistella is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology, out from Oxford University Press. We'll come back and talk more about the book and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Edwin Battistella. Ed is a linguist at Southern Oregon University, been teaching here since 2000, and is the author of a new book about apologies called Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology, going into some of the linguistic tricks that go on when people make apologies. And it goes back a long way in history. We mentioned already apologies by Abraham Lincoln. We'll go further back than that as well. And you can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our local Rogue Valley number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Ed, we were just talking about Harry Truman having to apologize to the Marine Corps League about an intemperate letter written to a Congress member. But he mentioned the Marine Corps being a police force for the Navy, but then threw in this thing about a propaganda machine.
Yeah, he said that they had a propaganda machine equal to Stalin's. And, you know, as you might expect, the congressman read the letter into the congressional record, and there were all sorts of calls for Truman to apologize. It turned out that the Marine Corps League was meeting later that week. So Truman wrote an apology letter to the commandant of the Marine Corps saying, you know, I apologize for my intemperate words. And then he went to the Marine Corps League in person and stood up and said, you know, when I make a mistake, I try to correct it and I try to make as few as possible. And a few months later, they inducted him as a civilian member of the Marine Corps League. So they accepted his apology, even though he never really apologized for the sentiment.
That's what I was going to ask you about, because, yeah, he apologized for his intemperate words, but that is not the same thing as saying I apologize for thinking the way I was thinking.
Yeah, so he stuck by his claim that the Marine Corps shouldn't be represented on the Joint Chiefs at the time, but just apologized, sort of minimized or pled to a lesser offense, kind of. And you find this in lots and lots of political apologies. I can think of just a half a dozen in the last year where people have made gaffes and said things, and then sort of say, well, I talk a lot, so I make a lot of mistakes. We shouldn't take misspeaking too seriously. And you find politicians on the left, the right, in the center, they all respond this way when they misspeak.
Well, misspeak. I was going to ask you about that word, misspeak and misspoke. It's past tense, because it seems like this is not something that people used to say a lot. I mean, I spoke out of turn, or I used a bad choice of word. Misspoke, though, is an interesting term, isn't it?
Yeah, this seems to be one of the more common ways that politicians are trying to apologize for saying things wrong. They talk about misspeaking, and in the last election cycle, I noticed that both Mitt Romney and Hillary Clinton talked about this idea that, well, I'm a politician and I talk a lot, I say a lot of things, so I'm going to say some things that are wrong. And that's pretty much all they say. They just say, well, kind of stuff happens.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah. It just happens.
And that's kind of the idea of the title of the book, too. We often just sort of dismiss things that we do wrong with this kind of glib sorry about that or my bad or stuff happens without really exploring what's wrong with it. And in some cases, politicians do mean the things they say, and they try to get away with this, oh, things happen, I misspoke. But sometimes they do misspeak, but often there's a kernel of truth in what they're claiming, or if they didn't get caught misspeaking, they would just let it go and not correct it.
Let's take some calls here. We have Grumpy John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ed Battistella. His book is Sorry About That.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Hey, Ed, how do you categorize such things as when Janet Reno deliberately incinerated a bunch of women and children in the basement of the compound there? Her response was, I take full responsibility for that. Period. End of involvement.
Okay, deliberate incineration is a little incendiary in itself, don't you think, Grumpy John?
I do not. I think that's exactly what happened. The fire department was notified to stay away. It was done deliberately, Jeff.
Your opinion. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, well, the idea of taking full responsibility for something is another one of these techniques that people use. Again, on the left and the right, the sort of classic example is John F. Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs invasion, where he actually went in a press conference, said something to the effect of, victory has 100 fathers, defeat is an orphan. I'm the responsible officer of the government. It won't really be useful to talk any more about this. And that was pretty much all he said about it at the time, and his approval rating shot up overnight. The other good example of this sort of in recent history was Ronald Reagan after the Iran-Contra scandal. Then they had an investigation by former Senator John Tower, and then Reagan went on national television and said something to the effect of, well, this happened on my watch. I'm the responsible party. What happens when things like this happen is you take your knocks and you move on.
Is this the same as the mistakes were made comment, or was that a different episode?
That was the Richard Nixon resigning from Watergate, which was, I mean, there was a little bit more personal culpability there. But you get this quite a bit where people will talk about, I'm responsible. When I'm most impressed with this is when someone actually resigns after they do it. Then there's a kind of consequence to it.
Where they take it seriously enough and have enough regrets that, okay, I really messed up, and I messed up enough that I shouldn't be here anymore.
Right. And part of a good apology is making some amends or showing how things are going to be different in the future. And you often find this with national apologies, the apologies for Japanese internment or the apologies that the Senate made for failing to stop lynching. These are often ones that kind of symbolically bring a community together. And in some cases, there are efforts made to make things better for the future.
Let us take another call. We have Jeannie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ed Battistella. His book is Sorry About That.
Hi. What prompted my call was when you said words mean things. Words are important. I clipped an article like that years ago. I'm sorry I can't find it to give credit to the writer. But what she said basically was that words mean things. Words are important. The word girl, for instance, unempowered, unenthroned, usually 12, adolescent. The word lady, owned by a lord or master of social class or distinction. Woman, gender only. And secondly, when people apologize a lot to me, I love being a smarty, and they'll say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. If it's repeated, as you said, I say, don't be sorry, just stop doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the part of the apology is people really need to, they need to say what they did wrong as well as just repeating, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. So one of the things that really makes a good apology is when the person can name what they did wrong or makes an effort to name it. So if you think about, actually, my wife and I were over at one of the restaurants sitting outside a couple weeks ago, and there was a little kid throwing rocks around, and he threw one sort of near our table, and his mother made him come over and apologize. And he sort of came over, and his eyes were down, and he was kind of kicking the dirt. And she said, "Say you're sorry." And he goes, "I'm sorry." She goes, "Say why you're sorry." And then he said he was sorry for throwing the rock. And, you know, we accepted his apology and went back to our appetizers and so on. But, yeah, part of it is really not just saying you're sorry, but saying what you did wrong.
I've noticed that is a trend that's gone on for a couple of years in schools anyway, that you have to say not just I'm sorry, but I'm sorry for what? Mm-hmm. Explain what it is you're sorry for. And it often helps that people can say, hey, you know, this was the behavior that led to it, and this is something I will work on and try not to do again.
Yeah, exactly.
Ed Battistella, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. You can join us here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Maybe you can remember a story of an apology or a particular public apology that made you either cringe or think, well, this person really means it. So share those with us. 800-838-3760 around the region, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You use Irving Goffman's definition of an apology, Ed. What is that?
Well, yeah, I was impressed with Goffman's work long ago when I started reading it, and then I came back to it during this book. He was really a sort of interesting character who saw the sociologist as a kind of detective that looks at ordinary interactions and tries to find out what's going on. So Goffman talks about this idea of a split self, and that when someone apologizes, they really split themselves in two almost, and the kind of current regretful self condemns the former self in a sense. So they really are saying that they're a new person almost. So Goffman looks at some of the different ways that apologies work and talks about the idea that someone making a sincere apology needs to be genuinely embarrassed, sort of commit to a new future, and really condemn their former behavior.
We have an email here from Scott in Ashland. He says, I wonder how you would react, Ed, to Eisenhower's handwritten statement to be released if the D-Day landings had failed. And he provides the text here. It says, our landings in the Cherbourg-Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone. This is purportedly Eisenhower's words, if the D-Day landings had failed.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't really looked at that one. I'll need to go back and sort of parse it bit by bit. I don't quite know what
the failure would be mine alone.
The failure would be mine alone. He's taking some responsibility. I mean, there's the if there's blame. It sort of reminds me a little bit of Robert Kennedy's statement on Vietnam in 1967, I think, where he said, if there's any fault to be made in the decision, if there's any fault to be had in the decisions, there's plenty to go around, including me, kinds of things.
So, interesting. So I'll take some, but I'll leave some for a few other people as well.
Yeah, so Eisenhower here is taking kind of full responsibility. And he was an interesting person as far as apologies go. He was the one who insisted that General Patton apologize to the soldiers that he slapped with his gloves. And I talk a little bit about Patton's apology there. And also, there was an incident in the 1950s where a diplomat from, I believe it was Nigeria, was refused service in a Howard Johnson's. He was the foreign minister of Nigeria. And Eisenhower and Nixon invited him to the White House for breakfast, And it was a sort of, you know, silent, symbolic apology. The State Department also apologized, but Eisenhower just sort of managed to make a symbolic apology without having his words become an issue.
Interesting. He did it by deeds, not by words.
Exactly.
Let's take a call here from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about apologies with Ed Battistella, the author of Sorry About That.
Boy, have I had to do this from time to time.
Haven't we all?
You know, the thing that I have found and developed over the years is the true nature of an apology is, and I think there are a number of components to it. The first is culpability, which you've been talking about here a little bit. I have to give a mea culpa. Yes, I was at fault. I did something about this. The second component, before you can give a true apology, is to forgive yourself and to make a personal commitment to avoid doing whatever is triggering the apology in the future, if you can, and then finally, literally asking forgiveness of the aggrieved party. You know, that's really what an apology is all about when you take it down and really look at the whole process that's going on there. And I don't see that in most of the public and political apologies that I have examined over the years. And I'd like to just have your comment on it, and I'll take it off the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And there's another piece, too, that I think enters into this that also is part of the problem for many public and political apologies, is that it requires a sort of realization of what you did wrong early on. Even before you name what you did wrong or forgive yourself, there needs to be this sense that there's something that I've done that's wrong that needs to be apologized for. And many politicians don't seem to feel that they've done anything wrong. They're just sort of apologizing because they have to. But what you find in a sincere apology is that someone really thinks about, you know, I've done something wrong and I need to own up to it and behave differently in the future, and then hopefully I can be forgiven. So often apologies take a couple of tries. You get a sort of fumbling beginning to it, but someone gets it right the second time, or sometimes it takes longer.
Paul certainly jogged my memory because it brought us back to the examples you gave earlier about some of the political candidates in the 2008 presidential process. But the sense that they're apologizing for, often for an act or a reaction to a specific act, while still saying, essentially, this is how I am, and so this is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So the best possible apology is one where someone sincerely says they're not going to do it again. And when you're talking about speaking and making sort of verbal gaffes and things like that, it's not possible to guarantee that, but you can revisit your opinions. So if you say something that's just an out-and-out lie, or something that you shouldn't have said because it's not what you believe, you need to sort of own up to that and not try to plead to this lesser offense.
There's some great apologies of history in the book, obviously. Samuel Sewall, what did he apologize for?
Yeah, Samuel Sewall was one of the judges in the Salem witch trials. And shortly after so he was basically, I guess, bullied by the other judges, including supporters of Cotton Mather and others, to accept this sort of, you know, weird spectral evidence that people were witches, that they had moles, or that they, you know, would quiver in various ways. And a couple of years after the witch trials, he came to realize that this was just a horrible thing that he had done. And he made maybe it was Massachusetts' first public apology. And it was done differently then. He actually wrote it out and handed it to the minister in his church to read during the church service. And it became sort of it was a turning point for him in particular, but also for Massachusetts. And a few years later, many of the witches were pardoned, and they established a Day of Atonement.
Because of Samuel Sewell's apology.
Because of Sewell's apology.
Okay, that was an amazing document, too. We'll talk more about apologies, past, present, and maybe even future as well. Ed Battistella is our guest. His book is Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. We're back to talk more with Ed and take some of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Southern Oregon University linguist Ed Battistella. Edwin Battistella is the author of the book, Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology, now out from Oxford University Press. It's an examination of the mechanisms we use in making apologies, particularly public figures, a lot of politicians, a lot of performers, and how they actually commit their apologies and whether they're actually committing a true apology along the way. Join us on the Exchange. A rich discussion topic here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Some great apologies of history you have here. We just talked about Samuel Sewell apologizing for convicting women as witches in early Massachusetts. Al Capp, the cartoonist, what did he apologize for?
Yeah, this was an interesting one. I was trying to find some, I had about 100 or so apologies, and as I went through, I tried to take out some that were kind of duplicates of others and add some that were a little bit unusual. And Al Capp, he was the cartoonist who did Little Abner. And he would occasionally kind of depart from the main script and do these parody things. And he did a parody of Gone with the Wind in the 1930s, I believe it was. Might have been 1940. And Margaret Mitchell and her husband took offense at this. And I guess the husband actually called Al Capp about it. And I think Capp hung up on him or something, which exacerbated things. So they threatened to sue Capp and the King Feature Syndicate for $1 for every newspaper that it appeared in for copyright infringement. And
typical Little Abner style, it was called Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, yeah. And that was close to the protected title that they had copywritten. So Capp had to apologize, and what he did was he did it in the comic strip, and he has Mammy Yoakum say so they have a cartoon Al Capp, and Mammy Yoakum is scolding him, saying, "Sartin people had their feelings hurt. You got to apologize, Mr. Capp. It's the code of the hills." And then in the last panel, he apologizes. So he's both being insincere by sort of, indicating that he was forced to apologize both by people having their feelings hurt and by Mammy Yoakum. But in the last panel, he apologizes and transfers the copyright for the strip in question to the Margaret Mitchell. So that was a sort of the only one I found that was actually delivered in a comic strip form.
Was this apology acceptable to Margaret Mitchell's people?
Well, they got I think the key part was that they couldn't use the comic strip or reprint it anywhere. So it took me quite a while to find it in one of the comic strip archives.
Oh, wow. But because of the fact that it had been disappeared.
Exactly.
Got it. Let's take a call from Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ed Battistella. We're talking about apologies in Ed's book, Sorry About That.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I am somebody who doesn't like the word apology or even the practice of apologizing, and I rankle a lot of people by that. And what I prefer, I think the world would be a better place if instead of asking someone for an apology, you ask them to explain themselves. If you said, "What was your intent in doing that?" I think that would be much more helpful, for instance, in situations in schools where a bully is beating up on someone. If you ask the kid to explain yourself, what was your intention, you would find that the kid's intention was to be a bully. And to get him to say, "I apologize." Well, it's just you're encouraging lies, and I don't like that. Apologies have become sort of like hitting a restart button, And if you would push people to explain themselves, it would make a difference. It's a curious thing that the word apology is not in the Bible. In the Bible, they use the word forgive, forgiveness, and repent, and repentance.
Is a tone
and
in there, too?
I think that's a better thing.
Yeah, and I think that the... I think you're certainly right about people needing to explain themselves. And there are two ways to do this. One of them, I guess, goes back to the sort of original sense of apology in the sense of, say, Plato's apology, where it was a defense of an action. So, you know, you can apologize without sincerity, but if you're trying to apologize sincerely and you name what you did wrong, that includes a certain amount of saying why you did the wrong thing. So I see it similarly to you, that it's important to name what you did wrong and say why it was wrong. But I think indicating that you're regretful as well is a helpful thing for someone to do, because it sort of makes them commit, not just explain themselves, but it makes them commit to a different sort of life in the future. Where I'm troubled by explanation sometimes is when it shifts over into excuses, and there's that sort of fine line between saying why you did something wrong and trying to justify it.
If it weren't for the mean guys in the other party and the vultures in the media, I wouldn't have been forced into the situation.
But it's the sort of Donald Sterling, I'm old, I was trying to impress this woman, et cetera, et cetera. He's saying why he did it, but it's not much of an apology, because all he's offering are excuses.
You know, I one of the things that I hear in what Steve was saying, at least it reminds me of this, is that when people do say, I apologize, and without a lot of explanation, it can be as simple as the kid saying, I'm sorry, without saying sorry for what, because it's easy to say, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, one of my favorite examples is... David Brinkley, the journalist, and you may remember this, during the 1996 election, he thought he was off the air, and he made a bunch of intemperate comments about Bill Clinton after he had just been reelected. And Clinton was scheduled to be on the air with him the next week on This Week with David Brinkley. So they continued the interview, and the first thing that Brinkley did was he apologized, and he said, last week I said some things that were wrong and impolite. I regret it. I'm sorry. And Clinton accepted the apology, and they managed to move on.
That's impressive.
So yeah, you have to admit, you have to say you're wrong.
And you know, to the audience that you offended often helps if you're doing that right in person. And not often an easy thing to do, but there it is. Let's go to Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ed Battistella. Brad, go ahead.
Yeah, I attended Richard III at a Shakespeare Festival yesterday evening. And in his dialogues with the other people in the play, he makes apology for murdering his other members of the court, and at the same time seems to be leading into his next conquest. And I was wondering if the author had any was familiar with that.
All right, thanks for that, Brad. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet, and I don't recall the exact passage offhand, but there are a lot of interesting apologies in Shakespeare, though, and I think I want to take a look at those. And there is a great sort of area to be looked at, just in terms of how apologies are treated in literature and whether they sort of really reflect what happens or whether they're kind of exaggerated. I've got a couple of examples of films where the apologies are much more sincere in the films, Frost Nixon, for example, or Patton, than they were in real life.
Right, so they embellish a bit on what actually happened.
Yeah, and I know in particular, Ben Radley, the former editor of the Washington Post, objected to the Frost Nixon film that Nixon never apologized, although he was treated as having apologized in the film. And I looked at Nixon's statements, and Bradley was right. Nixon did never apologize.
No, he did not. Let's go to Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ed Battistella. His book is Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology.
The one that's puzzled me for my 70-some years is, how does a mother to a daughter, father to a son, when there's a fiasco in the family, say, how do I apologize to you for loving you? Because if you didn't love the person, he wouldn't have been in the mix in the first place.
So it's, how do I apologize for loving you? I mean, so you're not apologizing for the act so much as just the feelings that led to it?
Apologize for loving. Maybe I wasn't able to give you the right advice. Maybe I wasn't there to stop something.
Oh, so apologize for a whole span of years, essentially.
Right, yeah.
Got it. All right, thanks for that, Jim.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, and I'm sort of puzzling over these. There are some interesting cases where people apologize for not doing things. And I need to think a little bit more about this. One of the things that I'm really enjoying is every time I talk to an audience, I come away with a bunch of new ideas of things that, you know, I wish I had looked into before, or I'll try to look into in the future. So I'm going to jot that one down and try and figure that out.
Do I hear you saying, Ed, that you apologize for not looking into some of these things earlier?
I suppose, yeah.
Well done, sir. There's a great side-by-side set of examples you've given here. Joe Biden apologizing for his comments about Barack Obama as being a neat and clean kind of guy. And why that worked, whereas Mel Gibson's apologies for his intemperate comments around police officers did not.
Yeah, this was... some of it has to do with whether the what the person's history is and the sort of relationships that people have. So in the case of Joe Biden making these odd comments about candidate Obama at the time, they were sort of racially tinged comments, and it was a fairly weak apology where a really sort of strong apology would have explored what was wrong with what he said. Sort of talking bad about a colleague and injecting race in the campaign and so on. But neither Obama nor any of the other former candidates that Biden had offended wanted to continue this discussion. It wasn't in anybody's interest to sort of explore the ethics of this any further. So they accepted the apology, and things worked out for Biden and Obama.
Oh, so it's sort of like when somebody says, I'm sorry, the other person says, okay.
Yeah.
And boom, it's just done right there. They wanted it to be over.
It was a fairly instrumental apology because they were on good terms to begin with and they wanted it to be over. Mm-hmm. Mel Gibson, on the other hand, when he made anti-Semitic comments after being stopped for drunk driving, he had had sort of a history of doing this in the past, and he offered a particularly weak apology to begin with. And the Anti-Defamation League said, we don't accept this apology. So Gibson came back later and made a stronger apology, which the ADL actually accepted. I don't know that it changed Mel Gibson's behavior, but it made him think about it in a different way, at least temporarily.
Ed, we talked earlier about Abraham Lincoln, and it turns out that his apology, at least one of the apologies in his life, might have actually saved his life in the 1840s. What happened there?
Yeah, Lincoln had... he had written one of a series of letters making fun of the Illinois state auditor. And the auditor did what any politician would do. He went to the editor of the newspaper and demanded to know who wrote these letters. Lincoln's name came up, and he wrote to Lincoln accusing him of writing all the letters. So Lincoln sends back this sort of smart-alecky reply saying, well, how do you know I wrote all of them? The upshot was that James Shields, the auditor, challenged Lincoln to a duel. And Lincoln wrote back yet another kind of smart-alecky response saying, well, if I were to apologize, here's what I might say. But I'm not going to apologize unless you withdraw your letter accusing me of writing all of the all of these newspaper articles.
Mm-hmm.
Shields decided to go ahead with the duel, and he was a pretty good shot, but Lincoln was 6'5", and Shields was 5'7", and Lincoln chose cavalry swords as the weapon. So in the end, the seconds of both men convinced them to call it off, and Shields withdrew his letter, and Lincoln sent along his apology saying, you know, I didn't mean anything by it, basically.
Huh. But you know, the placement of some of the incidents that you put in the book next to each other makes for some funny juxtapositions, because there's the apparent sincerity of Abraham Lincoln followed by Fuzzy Zeller's "I didn't mean anything by it."
Yeah, exactly.
About Tiger Woods.
It's some of these verbal efforts come up over and over again, and you can kind of see that they're common in sports, celebrity things, politics, and I'm sure we all use them interpersonally as well. I've tried to be much more discriminating about apologizing since working on this. I've noticed that I'm apologizing less, but I'm apologizing for things that I need to apologize for, not just sort of casual stuff.
So less often, but more sincere.
Yeah, exactly. Less often, but better apologies.
All right. A good thing to come out of this book. It's called Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. Ed Battistella at Southern Oregon University wrote it. It's out on Oxford University Press. Ed, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.